Tyson Oxner, and he will talk about the unlikely origins and impact of the Oklahoma Masonet Long-Term Terrestrial Observatory.
Thank you.
The floor is open for you.
Thank you. I'd like to tell you a story today about the Oklahoma Masonet, and I want to make it really clear at the outset that I should not have any credit for the Oklahoma Masonet. I didn't help create it. I don't help run it on a day-to-day basis. But my co-author, Chris Fiebrick, is the manager of the Oklahoma Masonet, and he deserves a lot of credit. So I want to make sure credit goes where it's due. And I want to start by just emphasizing the high impact that the Masonet has had. And some of you may be aware of this. Some of you may not be. But you can look and see thousands of peer-reviewed papers that talk about the Oklahoma Masonet. You can see over 500 papers that use Oklahoma Masonet data, and over 130 papers that have in their title Oklahoma Masonet. So very high impact scientifically. A series of grants from National Science Foundation also helped show the scientific impact. But I think I want to focus here on the social impacts. And those are hard to pin down, but estimates are over $2 billion in savings within the state of Oklahoma through better preparedness for natural disasters. And so, huge impact. And these data are used every day on an operational basis by a variety of industries in the state, as well as television stations, federal agencies. This thing is a fact of daily life in the state of Oklahoma. And the next thing I want to emphasize is how unlikely it is that this happened in the first place. We have this huge rivalry between Oklahoma State University and the University of Oklahoma. Yet these two competing institutions came together to create the Oklahoma Masonet, which is still to this day a joint partnership between the two institutions, despite our rivalry on the football field and in other places. In this one area, we work together very well. And the way that came about actually was the result of a tragedy. In 1984, on Memorial Day, which is in May, there was a very severe flood event. It started after nightfall. It started after people were in bed. It started to rain extremely hard in Tulsa, and they had about 15 inches of rain that night. And over at least 10 lives were lost as a result of that flood, and a huge amount of property damages. And so that got researchers started talking, especially at the University of Oklahoma. They were talking about how can we have improved flood warning systems. They knew they were going to need better weather data to accomplish that. This is around 1985, 1986. At the same time, researchers at Oklahoma State University were recognizing an increased need for better weather data at the agricultural experiment stations, which are spread out across the entire state of Oklahoma. And so the critical thing was these two separate groups at competing institutions came together and formed a joint steering committee, and equal number of people from each institution, and that steering committee has worked from 1987 until today to accomplish and sustain this vision that they had for the Oklahoma Masonet. And they worked for 7 years before they got their first legislative appropriation from the state. It's like Jacob working 7 years, just reminds me. And then they worked 13 years till the year 2000 before they got their first major legislative appropriation, and they have received that every year since then. So it's a long battle, but it has paid off in a huge way, because now we have this phenomenal observatory in the state of Oklahoma. It's collected over 22 years of data. This has approximately 30 full-time staff, 120 automated stations across the state, over 3,000 sensors reporting every 5 minutes, 63,000 data products and files delivered to end users every day, and about 700,000 new observations recorded every single day. huge, huge system. These are just very standard type of measurements. Now, there's nothing spectacular about the type of measurements that are being taken: air temperature, humidity, solar radiation, rainfall, and then near and dear to my heart, soil moisture and soil temperature at multiple depths under grassland vegetation, as well as a soil moisture and soil temperature measurement under bare soil, which is very relevant for agricultural purposes. So I want to show just a few ways that we're using these data just in my group, and there's lots of other great uses out there, obviously. And so at the bottom of each one of these next three slides, you can see the presentation time, which I will shamelessly advertise. I encourage you to go see more about the work that people in my group are doing. So one thing that we're learning about is what is the relationship between soil moisture and wildfire currents? We have lots of wildfires in Oklahoma. And by looking at the MESONET soil moisture data, which is shown here on the x-axis, we have now a histogram between the occurrence of large wildfires and on the y-axis, and then the soil moisture condition on the x-axis. And you can see that a great majority of the large wildfires during the growing season are going to occur once our normalized soil moisture value drops below 20%. And there's a variety of other findings that are coming from this work, so I encourage you to see that poster tomorrow afternoon if you're interested. Another thing that we're doing in our group is using the soil moisture data from the MESONET. We have over 15 years of soil moisture data, and by taking the data from a 60-centimeter sensor depth, we're estimating the drainage rate from the soil at 60 centimeters, and we think that's sort of an upper limit on the groundwater recharge potential. And so this map shows the long-term mean drainage rate at 60 centimeters. And you can see it varying from about 7 millimeters in the western part of the state to over 200 in the eastern part of the state. And Brianna will be giving a talk on that tomorrow at 2 p.m. if you'd like to learn more about that. Last application that I want to show, we're taking the observed soil moisture values and bringing in some other information and some modeling to try to create daily high-resolution soil moisture maps for the whole state. So this is an 800 meter resolution soil moisture map for the state of Oklahoma. And again, this is all driven by MESONET data. And you can see that poster this afternoon from 4 to 6. So Mark was just giving us four characteristics of a long-term observatory, which I thought were really good. And I want to end with sort of three things that I think were distinguishing features that helped the Oklahoma MESONET be so successful. And the first one I want to say is engagement of end users. These pictures are quite old, and that's intentional. The MESONET started to work on end user engagement before there was a MESONET. They were going out and doing K-12 teacher education and setting up educational resources. The first classroom computers in Oklahoma very often were connected to the predecessor of the Oklahoma MESONET, and they were educating citizens about how to use weather information from the very beginning. Not only that, they were learning about the information needs of the citizens and packaging information in specialized ways that was suitable for end users. So engagement has been key. Creativity has been a key, right? Because funding is always tight, and they've got to be creative about how to make this thing work. So one, just to demonstrate that, of course, they were setting up this network. They needed a telecommunication system for the network. So rather than creating a new telecommunication system at great cost, they found that they were able to partner with the Oklahoma law enforcement and use their existing telecommunication system to relay all the weather data. So even to this day, all the weather data from the MESONET and the soil moisture data comes in over the law enforcement communication system at very low operational cost. Finally, the MESONET has had from the beginning a commitment to research quality data, and that is a large commitment. So that starts with things like every sensor goes through the calibration lab individually and then is individually calibrated and then deployed very often in side-by-side sensor intercomparisons before going out to the field. And every site is going to get technician visits by skilled technicians at least three times a year. There are also automated quality control procedures that where the data are continually screened as they come in, and then round the clock, there are human eyeballs looking at all the data as they come in. So there's also manual quality control steps that are always taking place to ensure the quality of the data and to catch, you know, things like when an anemometer ices over or when an insect builds a mud nest inside the air temperature sensor. And so that commitment to research quality data has been absolutely key for the MesoNet. So when you hear this kind of talk, I think one natural reaction would be to think, well, yeah, that's great, but we don't have that in my state, or we don't have that in my country. And I just want to real sort of gently encourage you with the question, why not? And I mean that two ways. First, I mean, perhaps the research questions that you have might actually benefit from Oklahoma MesoNet data. Okay, so, you know, don't rule that out. A lot of people outside the state have benefited, and you might have some research questions you could explore using Oklahoma MesoNet data. So consider that. But number two, if you need this kind of system in your state or in your country, why not? If it can happen in Oklahoma, it can happen anywhere. I think the key is to have a dedicated group of people who get together across institutions and don't give up for that 7 or that 13 years until they see it happen. Just end with a quote from Benjamin Disraeli: "The secret to success is constancy of purpose." If you'd like to learn a little more about the MesoNet, I encourage you to whip out your smartphone and go to mesonet.org, or you can look at soilphysics.okstate.edu to hear more about our research program. Thank you.
Thank you for keeping in time. Nice presentation. So there's already a question.
Just curious if you have any idea how much the state of Oklahoma has invested in
this. Yeah, the question is, how much has the state of Oklahoma invested over the years? I don't know that cumulative figure, but Dr. Fieber may correct me on this. I think the annual appropriation from the state currently is around $2 million annually, and I think that covers about two-thirds of the operating budget of the MesoNet.
Another question?
Yeah. Do you think that rate of return on investment, if you're getting $2 billion in savings, is applicable to other states?
I have no idea. Unfortunately, Oklahoma is the most disaster-prone state in the nation, according to federal statistics. So we may be especially well-suited for this kind of need. I don't know.
Yeah, over there.
In that sense of disasters, what do you do about sort of upwind or information where you have state boundaries and you might have a good MesoNet yourself, but you've got to rely on Texas doing it also?
Right. Yeah, so the question was, when we're preparing for disasters, what do we, you know, obviously the weather phenomena, for instance, don't care about state lines. So what about outside the state? That is a great question. And, of course, we're going to rely a lot on partners, surrounding states, as well as federal agencies that work at larger jurisdictions. But that's an issue. There have been other states who have seen this example and started to pursue it. There is a West Texas MesoNet that does some of this, and Kansas has a little bit going on. And anyway, a lot of people are doing something. But yeah, there's a greater need for more of that coordination across state lines. That's a great point.
There's another question.
Just follow up that. So should that then become a state responsibility or a federal responsibility?
Great. The question is, should that be a state responsibility or a federal responsibility? Perhaps we should take up that discussion in the poster hour. I think that's a great question, but I think, again, wherever a community or a group of researchers is clearly sensing the need, where they clearly can identify the need, then it's simply a matter of persistently communicating the case to the people who are being impacted. And people are oftentimes reasonable, And if you can show that the impact perhaps is local within the state, then maybe the state will step up to the plate. But certainly there's a federal role as well.
Okay, thank you very much. We have time. There is a gap for more discussion. So thank you very much again.